I wanted people to think maybe the Essex butcher got her, or the bloke who sent the threatening notes.
How many times had you visited the Athorns before you killed Margot?
A few.
Because they needed a nurse, or for some other reason?
The longest pause yet ensued, long enough for the sun to slide out from a cloud, and the glass Cinderella coach to burn briefly like white fire, and then turn back into the tawdry gewgaw it really was.
"I sort of thought of killing them," said Janice slowly. "I don't know why, really. Just from the time I met them. They were odd, and nobody ever went there. Those cousins of theirs visited once every 10 years. I met them back in January, those cousins, when the flat needed cleaning out, to stop that man downstairs going to court. They stayed an hour and let Claire do all the rest. Yeah. I just thought I might kill the Athorns one day," she said, with a shrug. "That's why I kept visiting. I like the idea of watching an old family die together, and waiting to see when people realised, and then it'd be on the news, probably. And I'd know what happened when everyone was gossiping, local. I did a bit of experimenting on them. Vitamin injections, I told them it was. Special treatments. And I used to hold their noses while they were asleep. Used to pull up their eyelids and look at their eyes while they were unconscious. Nurses don't ever give anaesthetics, see? But Dr. Brenner was letting me have all sorts. And the Athorns just let me do stuff to them, even Guillaume. He loved me coming over. He'd spend days on Benzedrine, and then he'd get sedatives off me. Proper junkie. I used to say to him, 'Now, don't you go telling anyone what we're doing. These are expensive treatments. It's only because I like your family.' Some days, I used to think, I'll kill the kid and then give evidence against Guillaume. That was one idea I had. I thought, I'll get in the papers, all dressed up, give evidence against him, you know. My picture on the front page. And I thought, that'd be something interesting to talk to Steve about, when he see my picture in the paper. Men love nurses. That was the only thing I had going for me when I was out with Irene. And then the bitch starts pretending she's a nurse and all. Only thank God I never did any of that. Thank God I saved the Athorns. Because what would I have done with Margot if I hadn't had them up the road? I'd nicked their spare key by then. They never noticed.
I never thought it would work, said Janice. Because I had to throw the plan together in about 5 minutes. I knew she was on to me when she saved the chocolates, and I was up all night thinking, worrying. And it was the next day, or maybe the day after, Steve went charging out of her surgery that last time. I was scared she'd warned him about me, because when I went round that night, he made some excuse not to let me in. I mean, he never went to the police, so now I know I was being paranoid, but at the time...
You weren't being paranoid, said Strike. I spoke to him yesterday. Margot told him he ought to stop eating anything you prepared him. Just that. He understood what she was saying, though.
Janice's face grew redder.
That bitch, she said venomously. What did she do that for? She had a rich husband and a lover wanting her back. Why's she got to take Steve off me?
Go on, said Strike. About how you did it.
A subtle change now came over Janice. Previously, she'd seemed diffident, matter-of-fact, or even ashamed of her own impetuousness. But now, for the first time, she seemed to enjoy what she was saying, as though she killed Margot Bamborough all over again in the telling.
Went out with Larry. Told him some bullshit about this poor family what needed to concrete over something on their roof terrace. Said they were dirt poor. He was so keen to impress me, silly sod. He wanted to go do the building work for them.
She rolled her eyes.
I had to give him all this crap about how that would make the dad feel inadequate.
I said, just nicking a few bags of concrete mix off the building site would be enough. Larry drove it to Albemarle Way for me and carried it up to their landing. I wouldn't let him come any further. Said it would be unethical for him to see patients. He was silly, Larry. You could tell him anything. But he wouldn't marry me, said Janice suddenly. Why is that? Why wouldn't anyone marry me? What haven't I got that other women have?
Asked the nurse, who'd pulled back the eyelids from her drugged victims to stare into their unseeing eyes.
Nobody ever wanted to marry me. Never. I wanted to be in a paper in a white dress. I wanted my day in church and I never got it. Never.
You needed an alibi as well as concrete, presumably, said Strike, ignoring her question. I assume you chose the demented old lady in Gopsall Street because she couldn't say one way or another whether you'd been with her when Margot disappeared.
Yeah, said Janet, returning to her story. I went to see her late morning, and I left drugs there and a note to prove I'd been in. I knew she'd agree I was there early evening. She didn't have no family. She'd agree with anything you said to her. I went from her place to buy a cinema ticket for the late night show, and I called up my babysitter and told her I'd be later than I thought because we were getting the last viewing. I knew Irene wouldn't want to go with me. She'd been making noises about not feeling up to it all morning. I knew she didn't have no bad tooth, but I pretended to go along with it. Irene never wanted to go anywhere we weren't going to meet men.
So, you went back to the surgery that afternoon. In through the back door, I suppose.
Yeah, said Janice, her eyes slightly unfocused now. Nobody saw me. I knew Margot had a donut in the fridge because I'd been in there that morning and seen it. But there was people around all the time, so I couldn't do nothing. I injected it with Nembutal sodium solution through the cellophane.
You must have been well practiced by now. You knew how much to give her, so she could still walk up the road.
Nothing certain, said the nurse.
Unlike Creed, she didn't pretend omnipotence, but then she'd also been, however reluctantly, in the business of healing as well as killing.
I had a good feeling for dosages, but you can't never be 100% sure. I'd heard she was going to meet some friend in a pub up the road, and she usually ate something before she went. But I couldn't be sure she'd eat it, or still be able to walk up the road after, or when it would really hit her. All the time I was doing it, getting the concrete and dragging the donut, I was thinking this won't work, it can't work. You're going to go to prison, Janice. And do you know something? Said the nurse, now pink-cheeked and fierce. By then, I didn't even care. Not if she told Steve about me. I thought, I'll go on trial and I'll tell him how he treated me like a mum and a nurse and took advantage, ran my flat all hours. He'll have to bloody notice me and hear me then, won't he? I didn't care. I just thought, I want you dead, lady. I want you dead. You with your husband and your boyfriend on the side, and my man coming to see you 3 times a week. Either she dies, I thought, and I'll get away with it, or I'll be famous. I'll be in the papers. And I liked the idea then.
She looked around her small sitting room, and Strike was certain that she wondered what her cell would be like.
I left the surgery and went round a long way to the Athorns. But when I let myself in, Guillaume wasn't there. I thought, OK, that's a problem. Where is he? And then Deborah and Sowen started moaning. They didn't want their vitamin injections. I had to get strict with them. I said to Deborah, it's these injections what's keeping you well. You don't take them, I'll have to ring an ambulance and get them to take you into hospital for an assessment. You could scare her into anything if you told her she'd have to go outside. I give Deborah and Sowen their vitamin injections, lying side by side in a double bedroom. Rolled them onto their sides. They were out for the count. So then I goes outside and I waits in the phone box, pretending to be on the phone, keeping watch. It didn't feel real. None of it. I didn't think it'd work. Probably I'd go into work next day and hear Margot passed out in the street, and then she'd started yelling the police down saying she was drugged. And I knew she'd point the finger at me. She didn't come for ages. I thought, it's over. She's eaten the doughnut and got ill in the surgery. She's called an ambulance. She's guessed she's got sick. There was this girl standing in front of the phone box, and I'm trying to see round her, trying to see. And then I saw Margot coming up the road. I thought, well, this is it. It was raining hard. People weren't watching. It was all umbrellas and cars splashing. She crossed the road, and I could see she was in a bad way, wobbling all over the place. She got to my side of the road and leaned up against the wall. Her legs were about to go. I come out the phone box and I says, "Come on, love, you need to sit down." Kept my face down. She come with me a few steps. Then she realised it was me. We had a bit of a struggle. I got her a few more feet just inside Albemarle Way, but she was a tall girl, and I thought, this is where it ends. And then I see Guillaume coming up the other way. It was me only chance. I called him to help me. He thought he was helping her. He helped me drag her up the stairs. There wasn't much fighting her by then. I told Guillaume some rubbish to stop him phoning the ambulance. Said I could treat her myself. Said he didn't want no police coming up looking round the flat. He was a very paranoid man about the authorities, so that worked. I says, "You go and see if Deborah and Sowen are still asleep. They've both been very worried about where you've been." And I had to give him a little sedative. I suffocated her while he was out of the room. It didn't take much. Held her nose, kept her mouth shut. Did to Margot what I'd been planning to do to the Athorns. "When I knew she was dead," said Janice, "I left her sitting on the sofa and I went into the bathroom. I sat on the bog looking at the flamingos on the wallpaper and I thought, now what? Guillaume's here. He's seen her. And the only thing I could think of was, let him think he's done it. He's crazy enough. I thought, I'll probably have to kill him too in the end. But I'll worry about that later. So I waited in the bog and let him go in the room and find her. I give him 5 minutes alone with the body. Then I walk back in, talking to Margot like I left her alive. 'You feeling all right now, Margot, love?' And then I says, 'What have you done, Guillaume? What have you done?' And he says, 'Nothing, nothing. I ain't done nothing.' And I'm saying, 'You told me you can kill people with your powers. Perhaps we better call the police.' And he's begging me not to. He didn't mean to. It was all a mistake. So in the end, I says, 'All right, I won't give you away. I'll make it disappear. I'll take care of it.' He was crying like a baby, and he asked me for one of my sedatives. He asked me to put him out. Can you believe that? I give him some downers, left him curled up asleep on Sowen's bed. It was really hard, putting her in that big box thing all on me own. I had to take out all the crap they kept in there, folded her up. Once I had her in there, I checked on all the Athorns, made sure the airways weren't obstructed. Then I ran back outside to the phone box. I says to Irene, 'Are we still on for the cinema?' And she says, 'No,' like I thought she would, thank God. So I go back inside. I was there till midnight, near enough. I had to mix the concrete bit by hand, and in a bucket. It took ages. Margot filled up most of that box thing, but it took a long time to get all the concrete round her. Then I closed the lid. It stuck to the concrete. I couldn't get it up again, so that was good. When they was all awake, I told Guillaume I'd taken care of it. I said to him quietly, 'The lid on that box thing has jammed. Best find somewhere else to put Sowen's toys.' He knew, obviously. I think he pretended to himself he didn't, but he did. I was there 3 times a week afterwards. I had to be, keeping him happy. One time I went round, and he painted all those symbols on the walls, like it was some sort of pagan temple or something. Weeks after, months after, I was worried sick. I knew he was telling people he'd killed her. Luckily, everyone thought he was a nutcase local. But it got bad towards the end. He had to go. I still can't believe I waited a year to get rid of him.
And around the time you killed him, you phoned Cynthia Phipps and pretended to be Margot, didn't you? To give the police another lead to hair after, and distract from Guillerm in case anyone had taken him seriously.
Yeah, that's right,
mumbled Janice, twisting the old wedding ring. And you kept visiting Deborah and Sewin as Claire Spencer?
Well, yeah, said Janice. I had to. They needed watching. Last thing I wanted was real social workers fiddling around in there.
And Deborah and Sewin never realised Claire was the same as Janice, the nurse.
People with fragile X don't recognise faces easy, said Janice. I change me hair colour and use me glasses. I've done a lot to keep them healthy, you know. Vitamin D for Deborah, because she never goes outside. She's younger than me. I thought I might well be dead before anyone finds the body. Longer it went on, less likely it was anyone would ever know I had anything to do with it.
And what about Douthwaite?
He's scarpered, said Janice, her smile fading. That near enough broke my heart. There was me having to go out on foursomes with Irene and Eddie, and act like I was happy with Larry, and the love of my life's disappeared. I asked everyone where Steve had gone, and no one knew.
So why is Julie Wilkes on your wall? Asked Strike.
Who?
Said Janice, lost in her self-pitying reverie. The redcoat who worked at Clacton-on-Sea, said Strike, pointing at the young blonde with her frizzy hair who was framed on Janice's wall.
Oh, said Janice with a sigh. Yeah. I ran into someone who knew someone who'd met Steve at Butlin's a few years later. Oh, I was excited. Gawd, I was bored with Larry by then. I really wanted to see Steve again. I love a man who can make me laugh,
repeated the woman who'd planned the murder of the family for the pleasure of watching them die.
I knew there'd been something there between us. I knew we could have been a couple. So I booked me and Larry an holiday at Butlin's. Kev didn't want to come. Suited me. I got myself a perm and I went on a diet. Couldn't wait. You build things up in your mind, don't you? And we went to the club night, and there he was, said Janice quietly. Oh, we look gorgeous. Longfellow serenade. All the girls went crazy for him when he finished singing. There's Larry boozing. After Larry went to bed in the chalet, I went back out again. Couldn't find him. Took me 3 days to get a word with him. I said, Steve, it's me, Janice, your neighbour, the nurse.
She turned slowly redder than she'd been all interview. Her eyes watered with the intensity of her blush.
He goes, oh, yeah, all right, Janice. And he walks away. And I seen him, said Janice, and her jaw quivered. Kissed that girl, that Julie. And looked back at me like he wanted me to see. And I thought, no. After all what I've done for you, Steve, no. I did it on the last night but one of our holiday. Larry snoring his head off as usual. He never noticed I wasn't in bed. They all used to go to Steve's chalet after work. I found that out, following them. She come out on her own, pissed, 2 in the morning. It wasn't hard. There wasn't anyone round. They didn't have cameras around like they do nowadays. I pushed her, and I jumped in after her, and I held her under. It was a surprise what killed her. She took in a load of water on the way down. That was the only one I ever did without drugs. But I was angry, see? Got out, toweled myself off, mopped up all the footprints. But it was a warm night. You couldn't see nothing by morning. Next day I seen him, I says, "Terrible thing, that girl, Steve. You look awful. Want to get a drink?" He went white as a sheet. But I thought, well, you used me, Steve, and then you left me high and dry, didn't you?
A police siren sounded somewhere in the distance, and Strike, glancing at his watch, thought it was likely to be heading here, for Nightingale Grove.
"You took my sympathy and my kindness, and you let me cook for you," said Janice, still addressing an imaginary Steve Douthwaite. "I was even ready to kill my kid for you. And then you go off messing around with other women?"
"No."
"Actions have consequences," said Janice,
her cheek still burning.
"Men need to learn that and take some responsibility. Women have to,"
she said, as the police siren grew even louder.
"Well, I'll see him again in court, won't I? You know, I'm quite looking forward to it, now I'm thinking about it," said Janice. "It's not fun, living here all on my own. It will be funny seeing Irene's face. I'll be all over the papers, won't I? And maybe some men will read about why I done it and realise they want to be careful who they lead on. Useful lesson for men everywhere, if you ask me." "Actions," repeated Janice Beattie, as the police car drew to a halt outside her front door, and she squared her shoulders, ready to accept her fate. "Have consequences."
Part 7. Then came October, full of merry glee. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Chapter 72. They for naught would from their work refrain. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Success, as Cormoran Strike had long since learned, is a much more complex business than most people suppose. It wasn't the first time that the press had turned its sights upon the detective agency, and while the acclaim was undoubtedly flattering and a good advert for the business, it was, as ever, severely prejudicial to the partner's ability to keep working. Robin, whose home address was swiftly discovered by the press, took refuge at the house of Vanessa Equenzi, and with the aid of a number of wigs and some skilful makeup, managed to continue to cover a certain amount of work so that Barclay and Hutchins didn't have to do everything themselves. Strike, on the other hand, was forced back into Nick and Isla's spare room, where he let his beard grow and lay low, directing the agency's subcontractors by phone. Pat Chauncey alone remained based at the office in Denmark Street, taking care of administrative matters, stolidly opening and closing up each morning and evening.
"I've got no comment. You'd all do better sodding off," she croaked,
twice a day, at the knot of journalists hanging around Denmark Street. The eruption of publicity that followed the twin discoveries of a woman's body encased in concrete in a quiet flat in Clerkenwell, and a teenager's skeleton hidden beneath debris in the depths of an underground well in Islington, showed no sign of abating quickly. There were far too many exciting angles to this story. The separate excavations and positive identifications of the bones of Margot Bamborough and Louise Tucker. The comments from two bereaved families who scarcely knew whether they felt more relief or grief. The profiles of two very different killers. And, of course, the private detectives, now widely acclaimed as the capital's most talented. Gratifying though this was, Strike took no satisfaction in the way the press hounded either Gregory Talbot — what would you say to people who say your father had blood on his hands? — or Dinesh Gupta — do you regret giving Janice Beattie that glowing reference, doctor? — nor in seeing the Athorns led out of their flat by genuine social workers, frightened, displaced, and uncomprehending. Carl Oakden made a brief appearance in the Daily Mail, trying to sell himself as an expert on both Strike and Margot Bamborough.
but as the article began with the words, "Convicted con man Carl Bryce, son of the old practice secretary, Dorothy," it was perhaps unsurprising that Oakden soon slunk back into the shadows. Strike's father, on the other hand, was happy to continue associating his name with Strike's, issuing a fulsome statement of pride in his eldest son through his publicist. Fuming quietly, Strike ignored all requests for comment. Dennis Creed, who for so long had received top billing in any news story including him, was relegated almost to a footnote in this one. Janice Beattie had outdone him, not only in the number of her suspected victims, but in remaining undetected for decades longer. Photographs of her sitting room in Nightingale Grove were leaked to the press, who highlighted the framed pictures of the dead on the walls. The folder of obituaries kept in her china cabinet, and the syringe, the cellophane, and the hairdryer that Strike had found behind the sofa. The store of drugs and poisons retrieved from her kitchen were carried out of her house by forensics experts, and the rosy-cheeked, silver-haired nurse, dubbed the Poisoner Granny, blinked impassively at news cameras as she was led into court and remanded in custody. Meanwhile, Strike could barely open a newspaper or switch on the TV without seeing Brian Tucker, who was giving interviews to anybody who'd speak to him. In a cracked voice, he wept, exulted, praised Strike and Robin, told the world they deserve knighthoods.
"Or the other thing, what is it for women?"
"Damehood," murmured the sympathetic blonde presenter, who was holding the emotional Tucker's hand, cried as he reminisced about his daughter, described the preparations for her funeral, criticised the police, and informed the world that he'd suspected all along that Louise was hidden in the well. Strike, who was happy for the old man, nevertheless wished, both for his own sake and for Tucker's, that he'd go and grieve quietly somewhere, rather than taking up space on an endless succession of daytime television sofas. A trickle of relatives, suspicious about the way their loved ones had died under Janice's care, soon turned into a tide. Exhumation orders were made, and Irene Hickson, the contents of whose food cupboards had been removed and analysed by the police, was profiled in the Daily Mail, sitting in her swagged and flounced sitting room, flanked by two voluptuous daughters who closely resembled her.
"I mean, Jan was always a bit of a man-eater, but I never suspected anything like this, never. I'd have called her my best friend. I don't know how I could have been such a fool. She used to offer to go food shopping for me before I came back from staying at my daughter's. Then I'd eat some of the stuff she put in the fridge, get ill, call her, and ask her to come over. I suppose this is a comfier house than hers, and she likes staying here, and I sometimes gave her money. So that's why I'm not dead. I don't know whether I'll ever get over the shock, honestly. I can't sleep. I feel sick all the time. I can't stop thinking about it. I look back now and ask myself, how did I never see? And if it turns out she killed Larry, poor Larry, who Eddie and I introduced her to, I don't know how I'm going to live with myself, honestly. It's all just a nightmare. You don't expect this from a nurse, do you?"
And on this count, if no other, Strike was forced to agree with Irene Hickson. He asked himself why it had taken him so long to look closer at an alibi he'd known from the first was barely adequate, and why he'd taken Janice's word at face value when he challenged almost everyone else's. He was forced to conclude that, like the woman who'd climbed willingly into Dennis Creed's van, he'd been hoodwinked by a careful performance of femininity. Just as Creed had camouflaged himself behind an apparently fey and gentle facade, so Janice had hidden behind the persona of the nurturer, the selfless giver, the compassionate mother. Strike had preferred her apparent modesty to Irene's garrulity and her sweetness to her friend's spite, yet knew he'd have been far less ready to take those traits at face value had he met them in a man. Ceres is nurturing and protective. Cancer is kind. Instinct is to protect. A hefty dose of self-recrimination tempered Strike's celebrations, which puzzled Isla and Nick, who were inclined to gloat over the newspaper reports of their friend's latest and most celebrated detective triumph. Meanwhile, Anna Phipps was longing to thank Strike and Robin in person, but the detective partners postponed a meeting
until the first effusion of press attention died down. The hypercautious Strike, whose beard was now coming along nicely, finally agreed to a meeting over 2 weeks after Margot's body had been found. Though he and Robin had been in daily contact by phone, this would also be the first time they'd met since solving the case. Rain pattered against the window of Nick and Isla's spare bedroom as Strike dressed that morning. He was pulling a sock over his false foot when his mobile beeped from the bedside table. Expecting to see a message from Robin, possibly warning him that press were on the prowl outside Anna and Kim's house, he saw instead Charlotte's name. "Hello, Bluey. I thought Jago had thrown this phone away, but I've just found it hidden at the back of a cupboard. So you've done another amazing thing. I've been reading all about you in the press. I wish they had some decent pictures of you, but I suppose you're glad they don't. Congratulations, anyway. It must feel good to prove everyone who didn't believe in the agency wrong, which includes me, I suppose. I wish I'd been more supportive, but it's too late now. I don't know whether you'll be glad to hear from me or not. Probably not. You never called the hospital, or if you did, nobody told me. Maybe you'd have been secretly glad if I'd died. A problem solved, and you like solving things. Don't think I'm not grateful. I suppose I am, or I will be one day. But I know you'd have done what you did for anyone. That's your code, isn't it? And I always wanted something particular from you, something you wouldn't give anyone else. Funny, I've started to appreciate people who are decent to everyone. But it's too late for that too, isn't it? Jago and I are separating, only he doesn't want to call it that yet, because leaving your suicidal wife isn't a good look, and nobody would believe it's me leaving him. I still mean the thing I said to you at the end. I always will. Strike sat back down on the spare bed, mobile in his hands, one sock on, one off. The rainy daylight illuminated the phone screen, reflecting his bearded face back at him as he scowled at a text so Charlottean he could have written it himself. The apparent resignation to her fate, the attempts to provoke him into reassurance, the vulnerability wielded like a weapon. Had she really left Jago? Where were the now 2-year-old twins? He thought of all the things he could have told her, which would have given her hope. That he'd wanted to call the hospital, that he'd dreamed about her since the suicide attempt, that she retained a potent hold over his imagination that he tried to exorcise but couldn't. He considered ignoring the message, but then, on the point of setting the mobile back down, changed his mind and, character by careful character, typed out his brief response. "You're right. I'd have done what I did for anyone. That doesn't mean I'm not glad you're alive, because I am. But you need to stay alive for yourself and your kids now. I'm about to change my number. Look after yourself." He reread his words before sending. She'd doubtless experienced the words as a blow, but he'd done a lot of thinking since her suicide attempt. Having always told himself that he'd never changed his number because too many contacts had it, he'd lately admitted to himself that he'd wanted to keep a channel of communication open between himself and Charlotte, because he wanted to know she couldn't forget him any more than he could forget her. It was time to cut that last, thin thread. He pressed send on the text, then finished dressing. Having made sure that both Nick and Isla's cats were shut up in the kitchen, he left the house. Another text from Charlotte arrived as he was walking up the road in the rain. "I don't think I've ever felt so envious in my life as I am of that girl Robin." And this, Strike decided to ignore. He'd set off for Clapham South Station deliberately early because he wanted time for a cigarette before Robin picked him up and drove them the short distance to Anna and Kim's flat. Standing beneath the overhang outside the station, he lit up, looking out over a row of bicycles at a muddy corner of Clapham Common, where ochre-leaved trees shivered in the downpour. He'd only taken a couple of drags on his cigarette when his mobile rang in his pocket. Resolving not to answer it if it was Charlotte, he pulled it out and saw Polwarth's name.
"All right, chum.
Still got time for the little people, then, Sherlock?"
"I can spare you a minute or two," said Strike, watching the rain. "Wouldn't want people to think I've lost the common touch.
How's things? We're coming up to London for a weekend."
Polwarth sounded about as excited as a man facing a colonoscopy.
"I thought London was the heart of all evil."
"Not my choice. It's Roz's birthday. She wants to see the fucking Lion King and Trafalgar Square and shit."
"If you're looking for somewhere to stay, I've only got one bedroom."
"We're booked into an Airbnb, weekend after next. Just wondered if you were up for a pint. Could bring your Robin along, so Penny's got someone to talk to. Unless, I dunno, the fucking Queen's got a job for you."
"Well, she has, but I told her the waiting list's full."
"That'd be great," said Strike.
"What else is new?"
"Nothing," said Polwarth. "You sort of Scots bottled it."
The old Land Rover had appeared in a line of traffic. Having no desire to get onto the subject of Celtic nationalism, Strike said,
"If bottling's what you want to call it, yeah. Listen, I'm going to have to go, mate. Robin's about to pick me up in the car. I'll ring you later."
Chucking his cigarette end down a nearby storm drain, he was ready to climb into the Land Rover as soon as Robin pulled up.
"Morning,"
she said, as Strike hoisted himself into the passenger seat.
"Am I late?"
"No, I was early."
"Nice beard," said Robin, as she pulled away from the curb in the rain. "You look like a guerrilla leader who's just pulled off a successful coup."
"Feel like one," said Strike.
And in fact, right now, reunited with Robin, he felt the straightforward sense of triumph that had eluded him for days. "Was that Pat you were just talking to?" asked Robin. "On the phone?"
"No, Polwarth. He's coming up to London weekend after next."
"I thought he hated London."
"He does. One of his kids wants to visit. He wants to meet you, but I wouldn't advise it."
"Why not?" asked Robin, who was mildly flattered.
"Women don't usually like Polwarth."
"I thought he was married."
"He is. His wife doesn't like him."
Robin laughed.
"Why did you think Pat would be calling me?" asked Strike.
"I've just had her on the phone. Miss Jones is upset at not getting updates from you personally."
"I'll FaceTime her later," said Strike, as they drove across the common, windscreen wipers working. "Hopefully the beard'll put her off."
"Some women like them," said Robin, and Strike couldn't help wondering whether Robin was one of them.
"Sounds like Hutchins and Barclay are closing in on Dopey's partner," he said.
"Yes," said Robin. "Barclay's offering to go out to Mallorca and have a look around."
"I'll bet he is.
Are you still on for interviewing the new subcontractor together, Monday?"
"Michelle, yes, definitely," said Robin.
"Hopefully we'll be back in the office by then."
Robin turned into Kyle Road. There was no sign of press, so she parked outside a Victorian terraced house, divided into two flats. When Strike rang the bell labelled Phipps Sullivan, they heard footsteps on stairs through the door, which opened to reveal Anna Phipps, who was wearing the same baggy blue cotton jumpsuit and white canvas shoes as the first time they'd met her in Falmouth.
"Come in," she said,
smiling as she retreated so that they could enter a small square of space at the bottom of the staircase. The walls were painted white. A series of abstract monochrome prints covered the walls, and the fanned window over the door cast pools of light onto the uncarpeted stairs, reminding Robin of the St. Peter's nursing home and the life-size Jesus watching over the entrance.
"I'm going to try not to cry," said Anna quietly,
as though scared of being overheard, but in spite of her resolution, her eyes were already full of tears.
"I'm sorry, but I'd really like to hug you," she said.
And she promptly did so, embracing first Robin, then Strike. Stepping back, she shook her head, half laughing, and wiped her eyes.
"I can't ever express to you how grateful I am. What you've given me."
She made an ineffable gesture and shook her head.
"It's just so strange. I'm incredibly happy and relieved, but at the same time, I'm grieving. Does that make sense?"
"Totally," said Robin.
Strike grunted. "Everyone's here," said Anna, gesturing upstairs.
Kim, Dad, Sin, and Una, too. I invited her down for a few days. We're planning the funeral, you see. Dad and Sin are really leaving it up to me. Anyway, come up. Everyone wants to thank you. As they followed Anna up the steep stairs, Strike using the banister to heave himself along, he remembered the tangle of emotions that had hit him when he'd received the phone call telling him of his own mother's death. Amid the engulfing wave of grief had been a slight pinprick of relief, which had shocked and shamed him, and which had taken a long time to process. Over time, he'd come to understand that in some dark corner of his mind, he'd been dreading and half expecting the news. The axe had fallen at last. Suspense was forever over. Leda's appalling taste in men had culminated in a sordid death on a dirty mattress, and while he'd missed her ever since, he'd be a liar if he claimed to miss the toxic mixture of anxiety, guilt, and dread he'd endured over her last couple of years of life. He could only imagine the mixture of emotions currently possessing Margot's husband, or the nanny who'd taken Margot's place in the family. As he reached the upper landing, he glimpsed Roy Phipps sitting in an armchair in the sitting room. Their eyes met briefly before Kim came out of the room, blocking Strike's view of the haematologist. The blonde psychologist was smiling broadly. She, at least, seemed to feel unalloyed pleasure. "Well," she said, shaking first Strike's hand, then Robin's, "what can we say, really? Come through." Strike and Robin followed Anna and Kim into the sitting room, which was as large and airy as their Falmouth holiday home, with long gauze curtains at the windows, stripped floorboards, a large white rug, and pale grey walls. The books had been arranged by colour. Everything was simple and well designed. Very different from the house in which Anna had grown up, with its ugly Victorian bronzes and chintz-covered chairs. The only art on the walls was over the fireplace, a black-and-white photograph of sea and sky. Rain was beating on the large bay window behind Roy, who was already on his feet. He wiped his hand nervously on his trousers before holding it out to Strike.
"How are you?" he asked jerkily.
"Very well, thanks," said Strike.
"Miss Ellicott," said Roy, holding out his hand to Robin in turn. "I understand you, actually."
The unspoken words, "found her," seemed to ring around the room.
"Yes," said Robin.
And Roy nodded and pursed his lips, his large eyes leaving her to focus on one of the ragdoll cats, which had just prowled into the room, its aquamarine eyes shrewd.
"Sit down, Dad," said Anna gently, and Roy did as he was told.
"I'll just go and see whether Una's found everything. She's making tea," said Kim cheerfully, and left.
"Please have a seat," said Anna to Strike and Robin, who sat down side by side on the sofa.
The moment Strike was settled, the ragdoll cat leapt up lightly beside him and stepped into his lap. Robin, meanwhile, had noticed the ottoman that stood in place of a coffee table. It was upholstered in grey and white striped canvas, and far smaller than the one in the Athorns' flat. Too small for a woman to curl up in it, but even so, it was a piece of furniture Robin doubted she'd ever own, no matter how useful they might be. She'd never forget the dusty mass of hardened concrete and the skull of Margot Bamborough curving up out of it.
"Where's Sin?"
Anna asked her father.
"Bathroom," said Roy, a little hoarsely.
He threw a nervous glance at the empty landing beyond the door before addressing the detective.
I have to tell you how ashamed I am that I never hired anybody myself. Believe me, the thought that we could have known all this 10, 20 years ago...
"Well, that's not very good for our egos, Roy," said Strike, stroking the purring cat, "implying that anyone could have done what we did."
Roy and Anna both laughed harder than the comment deserved, but Strike understood the need for the release of jokes after a profound shock. Mere days after he'd been airlifted out of the bloody crater where he'd lain after his leg had been blown off, fading in and out of consciousness, with Gary Topley's torso beside him, he seemed to remember Richard Anstis, the other survivor, whose face had been mangled in the explosion, making a stupid joke about the savings Gary could have made on trousers had he lived.
Strike could still remember laughing at the idiotic, tasteless joke and enjoying a few seconds' relief from shock, grief, and agony. Women's voices now came across the landing. Kim had returned with a tea tray, followed by Una Kennedy, who was bearing a large chocolate cake. She was beaming from beneath her purple-streaked fringe, her amethyst cross bouncing on her chest as before, and when she'd put down the cake, she said, "Here they are, then, the heroes of the hour. I'm going to hug the pair of you." Robin stood to receive her tribute, but Strike, not wanting to disarrange the cat, received his hug awkwardly while sitting. "Oh, here I go again," said Una, laughing as she straightened up and wiping her eyes. "I swear to God it's like being on a roller coaster. Up one minute, down the next." "I did the same when I saw them," said Anna, laughing at Una. Roy's smile, Robin noticed, was nervous and a little fixed. What did it feel like, she wondered, to be face to face with his dead wife's best friend after all these years? Did the physical changes in Una make him wonder what Margot would have looked like had she lived to the age of 70? Or was he wondering anew, as he must have done over all the intervening years, whether his marriage would have survived the long stretch of icy silence that had followed her drink with Paul Satchwell? Whether the strains and tensions in the relationship could have been overcome, or whether Margot would have taken Una up on her offer of refuge in her flat? They'd have divorced, Robin thought, with absolute certainty. But then she wondered whether she wasn't tangling up Margot with herself, as she'd tended to do all through the case.
"Oh, hello,"
said a breathless voice from the doorway, and everyone looked around to see Cynthia, on whose thin, sallow face was a smile that didn't quite reach her anxious, mottled eyes. She was wearing a black dress, and Robin wondered whether she'd consciously put it on to suggest mourning.
"Sorry, I was... How are you both?"
"Fine," said Robin.
"Great," said Strike.
Cynthia let out one of her nervous, breathless laughs and said,
"Yes, no, so wonderful."
Was it wonderful for Cynthia? Robin wondered, as Anna's stepmother pulled up a chair, and she declined a piece of cake, which, it transpired, Una had gone out in the rain to purchase. How did it feel to have Margot Bamborough back, even in the form of a skeleton in a box? Did it hurt to see her husband so shaken and emotional, and to have to receive Una, Margot's best friend, into the heart of the family, like a newly discovered aunt? Robin, who seemed to be on something of a clairvoyant streak, felt sure that if Margot had never been killed, but had simply divorced Roy, Cynthia would never have been the haematologist's choice of second wife. Margot would probably have begged the young Cynthia to accompany her into her new life and continue looking after Anna. Would Cynthia have agreed, or would her loyalties have lain with Roy? Where would she have gone, and who would she have married once there was no place for her at Broom House? The second cat now entered the room, staring at the unusually large group it found inside. She picked her way past the armchairs, the ottoman, and the sofa, jumped up onto the window sill, and sat with her back to them, watching the raindrops sliding down the window. "Now, listen," said Kim, from the upright chair she'd brought out of a corner of the room. "We really do want to pay you for the extra month you put in. I know you said no, it was our choice to keep working on the case," said Strike. "We're glad to have helped, and we definitely don't want more money." He and Robin had agreed that, as the Margot Bamborough case looked likely to pay for itself three times over, in terms of publicity and extra work, and as Strike felt he really should have solved it sooner, taking more cash from Anna and Kim felt unnecessarily greedy. "Then we'd like to make a donation to charity," said Kim. "Is there one you'd like us to support?"
"Well," said Strike, clearing his throat, "if you're serious, Macmillan Nurses."
He saw a look of surprise on the family's faces.
"My aunt died this year," he explained, "and the Macmillan nurse gave her a lot of support."
"Oh, I see," said Kim, with a slight laugh, and there was a little pause in which the spectre of Janice Beattie seemed to rise up in the middle of them, like the wisp of steam issuing from the teapot spout. "A nurse," said Anna quietly. "Who'd suspect a nurse?"
"Margot,"
said Roy and Una together. They caught each other's eye and smiled, a rueful smile, doubtless surprised at finding themselves in agreement at long last, and Robin saw Cynthia look away.
"She didn't like that nurse, she told me so," said Una. "But I got the woman confused with that blonde at the Christmas party who made a scene."
"No, she never took to the nurse," said Roy. "She told me, too, when she joined the practice. I didn't take much notice."
He seemed determined to be honest now, however much it hurt.
"I thought it was a case of two women being too similar, both working class, both strong characters. When I met the woman at the barbecue, I actually thought she seemed quite, well, decent. Of course, Margot never told me her suspicions."
There was another silence, and everyone in the room, Strike was sure, was remembering that Roy hadn't spoken to his wife at all in those few weeks before her murder, which was precisely the time period during which Margot's suspicions of Janice must have crystallized.
"Janice Beattie's probably the best lawyer I've ever met," Strike said, into the tense atmosphere. "And a hell of an actress."
"I've had the most extraordinary letter," said Anna. "From her son, Kevin. Did you know he's coming over from Dubai to testify against her?"
"We did," said Strike, who George Laybourne was briefing regularly on the progress of the police investigation.
"He wrote that he thinks Mum examining him saved his life," said Anna. Robin noticed how Anna was now calling Margot Mum, when previously she'd only said, "my mother." "It's a remarkable letter," said Kim, nodding, "full of apologies as though it's somehow his fault."
"Poor man,"
said Una quietly. "He says he blames himself for not going to the police about her. But what child would believe his mother's a serial killer?"
"I really can't," said Anna again, over the purring of Cagney the cat in Strike's lap, "explain adequately to you both what you've done for me, for all of us. The not knowing's been so terrible. And now I know for sure that Mum didn't leave willingly and that she went, well, quite peacefully."
"As deaths go," said Strike, "it was almost painless."
"And I know for sure she loved me," said Anna.
"We always," began Cynthia, but her stepdaughter said quickly,
"I know you always told me she did sin. But without knowing what really happened, there was always going to be a doubt, wasn't there? But when I compare my situation with Kevin Beattie's, I actually feel lucky."
"Do you know," Anna asked Strike and Robin, "what they found when they, you know, got Mum out of the concrete?"
"No," said Strike.
Cynthia's thin hands were playing with her wedding ring, twisting it around her finger.
"The locket Dad gave her," said Anna. "It's tarnished, but when they opened it up, it had a picture of me in it, which was as good as new," said Anna,
and her eyes suddenly shone with tears again. Una reached out and patted Anna on the knee.
"They say I'll be able to have it back, once they've completed all the forensics."
"How lovely," said Robin quietly. "And did you hear what was in her handbag?" asked Kim.
"No," said Strike.
"Notes from her consultation on Theo," said Kim. "They're completely legible, protected by the leather, you know. Her full name was Theodosia Loveridge, and she was from a traveller family. Margot suspected an ectopic pregnancy and wanted to ring an ambulance, but Theo said her boyfriend would take her. Margot's notes suggest Theo was scared of her family knowing she was pregnant. They don't seem to have approved of the boyfriend."
"So that's why she never came forward afterwards," said Robin.
"I suppose so," said Kim. "Poor girl. I hope she was okay."
"May I ask," said Roy, looking at Strike, "how strong you think the case against Janice Beattie is? Because I don't know what your police contacts have told you, but the latest we've heard is that forensics haven't been able to prove Margot was drugged."
"Not so far," said Strike, who'd spoken to George Laybourne the previous evening, "but I've heard they're going to try some newfangled way of getting traces of drugs and chemicals out of the concrete surrounding the body.
No guarantees, but it was used successfully in a case in the States recently.
But if they can't prove she was drugged, said Roy, his expression intense, the case against Janice is entirely circumstantial, isn't it?
Her lawyer's certainly trying to get her off, judging by his comments to the press, said Kim.
He'll have his work cut out for him, said Strike. The defence has got to come up with reasons the police found a phone belonging to a non-existent social worker in her house, and why the Athorns had the number. The Athorns' cousins in Leeds can identify her as the woman who helped them muck out the flat. Gloria Conti's willing to come over to testify about the donut in the fridge, and the vomiting attack she and Wilma suffered. And Douthwaite's going to take the stand.
He is, said Una, her expression clearing.
Oh, that's good. We've been worried about him.
I think he finally realizes the only way out of this is going through with it, said Strike. He's ready to testify that from the moment he started eating food prepared by Janice, he had symptoms of poisoning, and, most importantly, that during their last consultation, Margot advised him not to eat anything else prepared by Janice. Then we've got Kevin Beatty testifying that his daughter drank bleach while Janice was supposedly looking after her, and that his mother used to feed him special drinks that made him feel ill.
What else? Said Strike, inviting Robin to continue, mainly so he could eat some cake.
Well, there are all the lethal substances they've taken out of Janice's kitchen, said Robin, not to mention the fact that she tried to poison Cormoran's tea when he went round there to confront her. There's also the drugged food the police have found at Irene's, and the framed photographs on her wall, including Joanna Hammond, who she claimed never to have met, and Julie Wilkes, who drowned at the Clacton-on-Sea Butlins. And the police are confident they're going to be able to get forensic evidence out of other victims' graves, even if Margot's results are inconclusive. Janice had her ex-partner Larry cremated, but his lover Claire was buried and she's being exhumed.
Personally, said Strike, who'd managed to eat half his slice of chocolate cake while Robin was talking,
I think she's going to die in jail.
Well, that's good to hear, said Roy, looking relieved. And Cynthia said breathlessly, Yes, no, definitely.
The cat at the window looked around and then, slowly, turned to face the rain again, while its twin pawed idly at Strike's sweater.
And you two will come to the funeral, won't you? Asked Anna.
We'd be honoured, said Robin, because Strike had just taken another big mouthful of cake.
We're leaving the arrangements up to Anna, said Roy. She's taking the lead.
I'd like Mum to have a proper grave, said Anna. Somewhere to visit, you know. All these years without knowing where she is. I want her where I can find her.
I can understand that, said Strike.
You really don't know what you've given me, said Anna, for the third time. She'd reached out a hand to Una, but she was looking at Cynthia. I've got Una now, as well as Sin, who's been the most wonderful mother. Mum certainly chose the right person to raise me. As Cynthia's face crumpled, Strike and Robin both looked tactfully away, Robin at the cat at the window, and Strike at the seascape over the mantelpiece. The rain drummed against the window, the cat in his lap purred, and he remembered the lily urn bobbing away. With a twist in his chest, and in spite of his satisfaction at having done what he'd set out to do, he wished he could have called Joan and told her the end of Margot Bamborough's story, and heard her say she was proud of him one last time.
Chapter 73 For natural affection soon doth cess, and quenched is with Cupid's greater flame. But faithful friendship doth them both suppress, and them with maistering discipline doth tame, through thoughts aspiring to eternal fame. For as the soul doth rule the earthly mass, and all the service of the body frame, so love of soul doth love of body pass, no less than perfect gold surmounts the meanest brass. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Robin woke a few days later to autumn sunshine streaming through the gap in her curtains. Glancing at her mobile,
she saw to her amazement that it was 10 in the morning, which meant she'd just enjoyed the longest sleep she'd had all year. Then she remembered why she was having a lie-in. Today was the 9th of October, and it was her birthday. Isla had arranged a dinner in her honour the following evening, which was a Friday. Isla had chosen and booked the smart restaurant, to which she and Nick, Vanessa and her fiancé Oliver, Barclay, Hutchins and their wives, Max, his new boyfriend, the lighting director on his TV show, and Strike, were all invited. Robin had no plans for today, her actual birthday, which Strike had insisted she take off. She now sat up in bed yawning and looked at the packages lying on her chest of drawers opposite, which were all from her family. The small package from her mother had the appearance of a piece of jewellery, doubtless in tribute to this milestone birthday. Just as she was about to get out of bed, her phone beeped and she saw a text from Strike. "I know you're supposed to be having a day off, but something's come up. Please can you meet me at the Shakespeare's Head, Marlborough Street, 5 p.m. Dress smart. Might need to go on somewhere upmarket." Robin read this twice, as though she might have missed a happy birthday. Surely, surely, he hadn't forgotten again. Or did he think that, by planning to turn up at the dinner Isla had planned, he was doing all that was required, and the actual day of her birth required no acknowledgement? True, she felt at a slightly loose end without work and with none of her friends available, but Strike wasn't to know that. So it was with very mixed feelings that she texted back, "Okay." However, when she arrived upstairs in her dressing gown to fetch a cup of tea, Robin found a large box sitting on the kitchen table, with a card on top of it, her name on the envelope in Strike's unmistakable, cramped, hard-to-read writing. Max, she knew, had left the flat early to film outdoor scenes in Kent, taking Wolfgang with him, who'd sleep in the car and enjoy a lunchtime walk. As she hadn't heard the doorbell, she had to conclude that Strike had somehow transferred both box and card to Max ahead of time to surprise her with this morning. This argued degrees of planning and effort that seemed highly uncharacteristic. Moreover, she'd never received a proper card from Strike, not even when he'd bought her the green dress after solving their first case. The front of the birthday card was somewhat generic and featured a large glittery pink number 30. Inside, Strike had written, "Happy birthday. This isn't your real present. You'll get that later. Not flowers. Love, Strike. Kiss." Robin looked at this message for far longer than it warranted. Many things about it pleased her, including the kiss and the fact that he'd called himself Strike. She set the card on the table and picked up the large box, which, to her surprise, was so light it felt empty. Then she saw the product name on the side, "Balloon in a Box." Opening the lid, she pulled out a balloon in the shape of a donkey's head, tied by a thick ribbon to a weighted base. Grinning, she set it down on the table, made herself tea and breakfast, then texted Strike. "Thanks for the balloon, donkey. Perfect timing. My old one's nearly deflated." She received an answer 60 seconds later. "Great. I was worried it was so obvious everybody would have got you one. See you at 5. Light-hearted now, Robin drank tea, ate her toast, and returned downstairs to open her family's presents. Everybody had bought her slightly more expensive versions of last year's gifts, except for her parents, who'd sent a beautiful pendant. A single round opal, which was her birthstone, shimmering green and blue, surrounded by tiny diamonds. The accompanying card read, "Happy 30th, Robin. We love you. Mum and Dad. Kiss." Robin felt her luck these days at having two loving parents. Her work had taught her how many people weren't that fortunate, how many people had families that were broken beyond repair, how many adults walked around carrying invisible scars from their earliest childhood, their perceptions and associations forever altered by lack of love, by violence, by cruelty. So she called Linda to thank her, and ended up talking to her mother for over an hour. Inconsequential chatter, most of it, but cheering nevertheless. It was easier to ring home now that her divorce was over. Robin hadn't told her mother that Matthew and Sarah were expecting a baby, She'd let Linda find that out in her own time, and work off her initial outrage out of Robin's earshot. Towards the end of the call, Linda, who disapproved of Robin's dramatic change of career ever since her first injury incurred on the job, mentioned the continuing press coverage concerning Margot Bamborough. "You really did an incredible thing there," said Linda. "You and... Cormoran." "Thanks, Mum," said Robin, as surprised as she was touched. "How's Morris?" her mother asked, in a would-be casual tone. "Oh, we sacked him," said Robin cheerfully, forgetting that she hadn't told her mother that either. "His replacement starting next week. Woman called Michelle Greenstreet. She's great." After showering, Robin returned to her bedroom to blow-dry her hair properly, ate lunch watching TV, then returned downstairs to change into the figure-hugging blue dress that she'd last worn when persuading Shifty's PA to give up her secrets. She added the opal necklace, which, since she'd left her engagement ring behind when leaving Matthew, was now the most valuable piece of jewellery she owned. The beautiful stone, with its iridescent flecks, lifted the appearance of the old dress, and for once pleased with her appearance, Robin picked up the second of her handbags, which was slightly smarter than the one she usually took to the office, and went to pick up her mobile phone from her bedside table. The drawer of the bedside table was slightly open, and looking down, Robin glimpsed the Thoth tarot pack sitting inside. For a moment, she hesitated. Then, under the smiling eyes of the balloon donkey she'd installed in the corner of her bedroom, she checked the time on her phone. It was still too early to leave the house if she wanted to meet Strike in Marlborough Street at 5. Setting down her bag, she took out the tarot pack, sat down on her bed, and began shuffling the cards before turning the first card over and laying it down in front of her. Two swords intersected a blue rose against a green background. She consulted the Book of Thoth. Peace, the Two of Swords. It represents a general shaking up, resulting from the conflict of fire and water in their marriage. This comparative calm is emphasized by the celestial attribution, the moon in Libra. Robin now remembered that this first card was supposed to represent the nature of the problem. "Peace isn't a problem," she muttered to the empty room. "Peace is good." But of course, she hadn't actually asked the cards a question. She'd simply wanted them to tell her something today, on the day of her birth. She turned over the second card, the supposed cause of the problem. A strange, green-masked female figure stood beneath a pair of scales, holding a green sword. Adjustment. This card represents the sign of Libra. She represents the woman satisfied. Equilibrium stands apart from any individual prejudices. She is therefore to be understood as assessing the virtue of every act and demanding exact and precise satisfaction. Robin raised her eyebrows and turned over the third and last card. The solution. Here again were the two entwined fish, which poured out water into two golden chalices floating on a green lake. It was the same card she turned over in Leamington Spa when she still didn't know who'd killed Margot Bamborough. Love. The card also refers to Venus in Cancer. It shows the harmony of the male and the female, interpreted in the largest sense. It is perfect and placid harmony. Robin took a deep breath, then returned all the cards to their pack and the pack to her bedside drawer. As she stood and picked up her raincoat, the balloon donkey swayed slightly on its ribbon. Robin could feel the new opal resting in the hollow of the base of her throat as she walked towards the tube station along the road, and having slept properly for once, and having clean hair, and carrying a feeling of lightness with her that had persisted ever since she took the balloon donkey out of his box, she attracted many pairs of male eyes in the street and on the train. But Robin ignored all of them, heading up the stairs at Oxford Circus, and then proceeded down Regent Street, and finally to the Shakespeare's Head, where she saw Strike standing outside, wearing a suit. "Happy birthday," he said, and after a brief hesitation, he bent down and kissed her on the cheek. He smelled, Robin noticed, not only of cigarettes, but of a subtle lavender aftershave, which was unusual.
"Thanks. Aren't we going into the pub?"
No, said Strike. "I want to buy you some new perfume." He pointed towards the rear entrance of Liberty, which lay a mere 10 yards away. "It's your real birthday present. Unless you've already bought some," he added. He really hoped not. He couldn't think of anything else to offer her that didn't take them back into the realm of awkwardness and possible misunderstanding.
"I..." "No," said Robin. "How did you know I've..."
"Because I phoned Isla. Last Christmas." As he held open the glass door for her, which led to a chocolate department now full of Halloween treats, Strike explained about his failed attempt to buy Robin perfume the previous December.
"So I asked the assistant, but he kept showing me things with names like, I don't know, Shaggable You."
The laugh Robin failed to repress was so loud that people turned to look at her. They moved past tables stacked with expensive truffles.
"And I panicked," Strike admitted, "which is why you ended up with chocolates. Anyway," he said,
as they came to the threshold of the perfume room with its cupola painted with moon and stars,
"you choose whatever you want and I'll pay."
"Strike," said Robin, this is thoughtful."
"Yeah, well," said her partner with a shrug, "people can change, or so a psychiatrist in Broadmoor told me. I'm going to stand here," he said, pointing at a corner where he hoped his bulk wouldn't impede anyone. "Take your time."
So Robin spent a pleasurable quarter of an hour browsing among bottles, spraying testers onto strips, enjoying a brief consultation with a helpful assistant, and finally narrowing her choice down to 2 perfumes. Now she hesitated, wondering whether she dare do what she wanted. But surely if they were best friends, it was all right.
"Okay, there are 2 I really like," Robin said, reappearing at Strike's side. "Give me your opinion. You've got to live with it in the Land Rover."
"If they're strong enough to cover up the smell of that car, they aren't fit for human inhalation," he said.
But nevertheless, he took the 2 smelling strips. The first smelled of vanilla, which reminded him of cake, and he liked it. The second put him in mind of warm, musky skin, with a suggestion of bruised flowers.
"That one. The second one."
"Huh? I thought you'd prefer the first."
"Because it smells like food."
She grinned as she sniffed the smelling strips.
"Yes. I think I prefer 2 as well. It isn't cheap."
"I'll cope."
So he carried a heavy cube of white glass, which bore the unexceptional name Narciso, to the desk.
"Yeah, it's a gift," Strike said when asked,
and he waited patiently as the price sticker was peeled off and a ribbon and wrapping added. He couldn't personally see the point, but he felt that Robin was owed a little ceremony, and her smile as she took the bag from him told him he'd answered correctly. Now they walked together back through the store and out of the main entrance, where buckets of flowers surrounded them.
"So, where?" asked Robin. "I'm taking you to the Ritz for champagne," said Strike.
"Are you serious?"
"Yeah, it's why I'm wearing a suit."
For a moment, Robin simply looked at him. Then she reached up and hugged him tightly. Surrounded by banked flowers, both remembered the hug they'd shared at the top of the stairs on her wedding day. But this time, Robin turned her face and kissed Strike deliberately on the cheek, lips to stubble.
"Thanks, Strike. This really means a lot."
And that, thought her partner, as the 2 of them headed away towards the Ritz in the golden glow of the early evening, really was well worth 60 quid and a bit of an effort. Out of his subconscious rose the names Mazenkov and Krupov, and it was a second or two before he remembered where he'd heard them, why they sounded Cornish, and why he thought of them now. The corners of his mouth twitched, but as Robin didn't see him smiling, he felt no compulsion to explain. You've been listening to Troubled Blood by Robert Galbraith, read by Robert Glenister. Directed by Garrick Hagan at Strathmore Studio, London. Post-production by Joseph Degnan.
There's an accompanying PDF available with this audiobook. If your retailer hasn't provided this in your listening library, you can download it from https://bit.ly/troubledbloodpdf using the password troubled. Text copyright J.K. Rowling 2020. Production copyright Achette Audio 2020. Extracts from the following lyrics were included in this audiobook. Come On In My House, words and music by Ross Bagdasarian and William Saroyan. Copyright 1957, Songs of Universal, Inc. International copyright secured, all rights reserved. Used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited and Bagdasarian Productions. Same situation, words and music by Joni Mitchell. Copyright 1973, renewed. Crazy Crow Music. All rights administered by Sony ATV Tunes LLC, 424 Church Street, Suite 1200, Nashville, Tennessee, 37219. Exclusive print rights administered by Alfred Music. All rights reserved, used by permission of Alfred Music. Court and Spark. Words and music by Joni Mitchell. Copyright 1973, renewed. Crazy Crow Music. All rights administered by Sony ATV Tunes, LLC, 424 Church Street, Suite 1200, Nashville, Tennessee, 37219. Exclusive print rights administered by Alfred Music, all rights reserved. Used by permission of Alfred Music. Just Like This Train, words and music by Joni Mitchell, copyright 1973, renewed, Crazy Crow Music. All rights administered by Sony ATV Tunes, LLC, 424 Church Street, Suite 1200, Nashville, Tennessee, 37219. Exclusive print rights administered by Alfred Music. All rights reserved. Used by permission of Alfred Music. Last Chance Lost. Words and music by Joni Mitchell. Copyright 1994. Crazy Crow Music. All rights administered by Sony ATV Tunes, LLC, 424 Church Street, Suite 1200, Nashville, Tennessee, 37219. Exclusive print rights administered by Alfred Music. All rights reserved. Used by permission of Alfred Music. The Gallery. Words and music by Joni Mitchell. Copyright 1969 renewed. Crazy Crow Music. All rights administered by Sony ATV Tunes, LLC, 424 Church Street, Suite 1200, Nashville, Tennessee, 37219. Exclusive print rights administered by Alfred Music. All rights reserved. Used by permission of Alfred Music. I Will Never Let You Down. Words and music by Calvin Harris. Copyright 2014. TSJ Merlin Licensing, BV. All rights on behalf of TSJ Mervyn Licensing, BV. Administered by EMI Music Publishing Limited. International copyright secured. All rights reserved. Printed by permission of EMI Music Publishing Limited. Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep. Lyrics by G. Cassia. Music by H. Stott. Copyright 1971 by Warner Chapel Music Italiana SRL. Play That Funky Music. Words and music by Robert W. Parisi. Copyright Beamer Music Co. Division. All rights administered by Universal MCA Music Limited. International copyright secured, all rights reserved. Used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited. Blame. Words and music by Calvin Harris, John Newman, and James Newman. Copyright 2014, TSJ Merlin Licensing BV, B Unique Music Limited, and Black Butter Music Publishing Limited. All rights on behalf of TSJ Merlin Licensing BV, administered by EMI Music Publishing Limited. All rights on behalf of B Unique Music Limited, administered worldwide by Songs of Cobalt Music Publishing. All rights on behalf of Black Butter Music Publishing Limited, administered by BMG Rights Management UK Limited. International copyright secured, all rights reserved. Used by permission of Hal Leonard Europe Limited and EMI Music Publishing Limited. This has been an Achette Audio production.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.